Welcome back, everybody, to Arts About. I'm Sally Bailiu, and you're listening to Arts About, brought to you by the generosity of the McClelland Sculpture Park and Gallery and facilitated by the Bendigo Bank Studio. This is a very special show because it's coming to you from the past. John and I have decided to have a few weeks off during the holidays, and so to prevent you all from deserting us, we've been compiling a few extra interviews in the weeks preceding Christmas for our technical producer Brody to compile and send out to you while we lounge about on banana lounges and slap on sunscreen. As well as the odd recent interview, there'll be a few oldies as well that we think deserve another airing, and there might also be the odd Will and Dr. Gabe too, which personally I think are some of the best work we've done, or they have at least. And I miss that they're not so regular these days because Dr. Gabe is so busy. Hope you enjoy them. There'll be some music too that we've selected over the years and perhaps even the odd John on. We've been doing this now for nearly 4 years, so there's plenty of material for Brody to play with. I hope it's entertaining and you're interested and it keeps you listening to us while the summer passes. We'll be back in person and answerable again at the end of January. In the meantime, enjoy the mixture. Picnic at Hanging Rock. Red Dog, Newsfront, Kokoda, Ten Canoes, Alvin Purple, The Sentimental Bloke, Priscilla, The Man from Snowy River, Mad Max, Lantana, Wolf Creek, The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, Welcome to Whoop Whoop, The Castle, Wake and Fright, The Cars That Ate Paris, Two Hands, Bad Boy Bubby, Razorback, Muriel's Wedding, Chopper, Harvey Crumpet, and Don's Party. This is only some of an enormous and important list of films that all have had a significant single fact in common. They're all Australian films, and we Australians have all contributed to them to some extent with a combination of our cultural identity and probably some of our taxes too. Unfortunately, Australian films rarely remain in cinemas for a long time, and once they reach their box office hiatus moment, they often disappear without a trace, or at least become very hard to access. Our next guest is about to change all of that. Ron Brown is one of two directors of a new streaming platform about to be launched next year called Ozflix. It's about to become an art gallery of Australian theatre, or at the very least, a one-stop portal for Australian film. Good morning and welcome to Arts About, Ron Brown.
Hi, Sally.
Thank you so much for coming on Arts About today.
Most welcome.
Ron, tell me how this idea has grown into Ozflix.
I started as a producer thinking about this back in about 2006 because I became aware that we were heading in the wrong direction. Fewer and fewer Australian films were succeeding at the box office. Fewer Australian films were making it onto television screens. And we didn't know then that the DVD side of things was going to change so radically, but it certainly was getting harder to get Australian films the sort of major launch support or distribution support that they needed. So what I started thinking then was that I might be able to convince somebody like a Channel 31 or possibly a Foxtel to screen Australian movies. I even had a wild idea at one stage that I would try to convince the ABC or SBS to put on an Australian movie of the week on, say, Sunday night or Monday night. But none of those overtures really came to anything. I went and spoke to people and made all sorts of presentations, did lots of research and wrote documents and all of that, and actually just kind of kept spinning my wheels. It wasn't until early this year, with Netflix launching and the kind of, you know, rapid uptake of internet streaming by people in their own homes, that I realised that the perfect solution, of course, was to make an Australian movie channel that was going to be delivered over the internet. And that's when I approached Alan Finney, who I've known for many, many years. I've known since the 70s, actually, when Alan was working in the independent film scene in Melbourne and subsequently went to Village Roadshow. And then, of course, he was CEO of Disney in Australia for 12 years and now chairman of the AFI, the Australian Film Institute. He's had a sterling career, and really I just felt that he would be an ideal person to help me get this going if he believed in it. So I called him and said, let's have a chat. And at that chat, he immediately engaged. He said, look, we have to do this. This is fantastic. I'd already done a lot of research on how we could do it technically and what sort of uptake there might be. I had projections and market research that I'd done and so on. So Alan was very keen, and we just decided then and there on the spot back in about April to form a partnership and to start building it and to fund it ourselves and to get it going.
Well, apart from a actually being an archive of Australian films that we can all access to our heart's content. It's actually going to create quite an extraordinary document, in a way, of Australian culture, isn't it? It's going to create an archive.
It's certainly going to do that. And, of course, Alan and I have both come from quite different ends of the industry. So we've got two different agendas that happily are going to be quite synergistic in this case. In the first instance, Alan has a long history in the distribution, the production and the distribution of Australian films. And he's got quite a strong love of the heritage of Australian cinema and Australian screen culture. And his agenda, I think, is that we can breathe new life or relaunch a lot of Australia's great classic cinema from the past that subsequent generations may never have heard of and certainly not had a chance to see. My agenda is a little bit different. I'm a producer and I've made three feature films in the last 10 years and realised that it's getting harder and harder to release them. So I see it very much. I stand in the shoes of you know, filmmakers in Australia to this day who are looking at fewer and fewer choices of ways to get their films in front of audiences. And, you know, I really see that it's an opportunity going forward for new films to be launched as well. So we've got both sides of the equation covered there. We've got the ability to bring out all of the great Australian films from archives and from people's cupboards and under their beds, as it were, and also the ability to launch new films as they become available as independent filmmakers are creating them, you know, in the years to come.
Yes, and the lure of a new way to reach your target markets actually was fantastic for new filmmakers. Yes, I agree. Tell me, how are you going to curate these films?
The first thing we've done is we've reached out. Alan and I sat down and drew up a list of... we both have quite a lot of reach in the industry, and we sat down and drew up a list of about 100 leading industry practitioners that we thought we should contact, that we could... I guess engage in the project in a way. I mean, at first we wanted to just sound them out and see if they thought it was a good idea and how they thought it might be realised, and to kind of add their sort of energy and thoughts and commitment to the project. But as we soon discovered, when we sat down and started talking to them, they quite quickly started volunteering to come on the channel in various ways and to curate and participate. So amongst the different kind of categories of people that we approached directors, obviously. We approached people like George Miller, and we approached Stephen Elliott, who of course did Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and we approached Scott Hicks, who did Shine and Snow Falling on Cedars, and we approached Fred Skepsey, of course. We approached Bruce Beresford. We approached lots of the leading filmmakers from, you know, the history of Australian cinema, but we also approached some very contemporary practitioners. We approached Creve Stenders, who directed Red Dog. We approached Clayton Jacobson, who did Kenny, and so on. And we asked a lot of questions of them about how they thought this might work and how it should work. But we also asked them at the end, would they see themselves as being involved in an ongoing way going forward? And they all said yes. Mm. We then went and spoke with actors. We spoke to writers and producers. We spoke to critics. And I guess this is where the curational thing started to come into focus, because we realised that all of the people that we spoke to, everybody wanted to be involved, wanted to help out. Stephen Elliott said, look, I don't think anyone's really ever interviewed me about the true story behind my intentions for the making of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. I'd love to tell that story. Mm. George Miller said to me, I'd love to talk about Ken G. Hall and the marvellous and seminal work that Ken G. Hall did as a filmmaker in Australia and that influenced me. And, you know, a lot of people started coming forward with these ideas. So the curatorial side will be partly about selecting films and presenting them in a certain way. It'll also be partly about bringing a lot of the practitioners back to the channel, to Ausflix, as presenters or guests, an interview program or hosting of segments about their favourite films or the influential films that they, you know, grew up with. That'll all be part of the offering. It'll be a very rich content sort of offering in that sense.
Sounds it. Now, to the other end, as a consumer, as an Australian who wants to access some of these films, how do you go about it? What do we see when we come to Ausflix?
When Ausflix is launched, you'll be able to go to a landing page, whether you're doing this on a smart TV or whether you're doing it on a smartphone or a tablet, if you're doing it on a computer screen, if you're doing it on even on a gaming console, Sally, you'll be able to go to Ausflix.tv, and when you get to Ausflix.tv on the landing page, there'll be all sorts of free content that you'll be able to watch. It'll include programs the programs will be in-depth kind of question and answer type programs with leading Australian stars and directors. There'll be other programs which will be kind of consumer guides to some Australian movies. There'll be a section of new films that we're launching that you've never heard of. There'll be reviews, there'll be behind the scenes and making ofs and all that sort of stuff. So that's all going to be available free. And then it will lead you to the next stage, which is where you can search. The search box will be on the front page, but you'll be able to then search for any of these films. So any of the films that, you know, have been reviewed or talked about or, you know, any of the free content sort of connects with will allow you then to go through and search for the films. Of course, if you just want to, if you know for a fact that you just want to go and see The Last of the Knuckle Men or you just want to go and see Puberty Blues, you can then type in Last of the Knuckle Men or Puberty Blues and you'll go straight to that. But you will pay for that. That's a pay-per-view or rental kind of streaming system.
We're completely used to that already, so that's nothing.
We are. Yeah. Look, what we've done, Sally, there too, is we've used the old DVD shop model, the DVD library model, because that's something that people are very familiar with, comfortable and agreed with in a business sense in the days gone by, and we feel that that's still valid. So we will, for example, have new releases at a slightly higher price, but we'll have classics at a much lower price. And we're also going to have something that I just used to love about the old DVD stores, which was a bundle where you could rent five films for $5 or mm-hmm. 10 films for $10 and have a week or two to watch them. So we'll be doing the same thing. We'll have bundles, and the bundles will be themed. You'll be able to, for example, we just actually have been working on this recently, so it's fresh in my mind, but we've created all sorts of fun bundles, not just around stars or directors, but also around themes. We have a bundle, for example, around the theme of the journey, and we start with Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, a classic Aussie journey film, but there's four other films in that bundle which are various sort of journey stories. I don't want to spoil too much of our announcements on Australia Day by kind of being too particular, but there's a journey around home, there's a journey around romance, and there's other themes. So those themes will be part of the the bundle offerings, and they'll be kind of based on the old, you know, 5 for $5 type model.
Personally, I'm very excited by the prospect. Tell me, when's your launch date?
We haven't set a launch date because we're still building the site. Mm-hmm. So it's up to our chief technical officer to tell me, with plenty of warning, I hope. Look, mm-hmm. it's all going to be built and ready, and we'll be able to press the button on this date, and then we, of course, will go out and announce that. We're hoping to make that announcement actually on Australia Day 2016. We're hoping to be able to tell the public that the launch date will be, you know,
yeah, that's it. It would be great, but honestly, it's definitely worth waiting for whenever it might be. I can't even imagine the magnitude of putting together a website that's going to facilitate all of this. It's really exciting. People are probably going to want to hear a little bit more about it. I imagine you have a website now that people can go to hear a little bit more.
If you go to ozflix.tv, ozflix.tv, you will find a video there. It lasts for only 4 or 5 minutes, in which lots of the people that I was mentioning before have just kind of lent their voice to the project, and you'll see that. And there's also a place where you can register your email address to get newsletters and updates and inside information about what's coming. And we are also now starting to produce a fortnightly little thing which we call the production report, which is a little sort of 1.5-2 minute video which we're putting on things like YouTube and Facebook and so forth, and letting people know about the progress of building. So if you're really keen and you want to find out about it as it's being built, the best place to go is to our Facebook page, which is just facebook.com/OzflixNet, OzflixNet, and that allows you to sort of get all the updates and all the information.
Terrific. That's really exciting. I have registered, so I will make a link on our Facebook page as well to keep our listeners up to date. It's really, really exciting. Thank you so much for talking to us today about it, Ron Brown. We really look forward to the launch coming soon.
Thank you, Sally.
Great. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, good morning. I'm here again with Dr. Gabe North, and I'm having to chase her all over the country, it seems, in the last few weeks. We've been up in northern New South Wales, we've been to her holiday home, and now I'm in the tropics of all places and bringing 3RPP to you once again. Welcome, Dr. Gabe North.
Thanks for having me, Will. Thanks for joining me here on sabbatical.
Sabbatical, eh? It sounds very important, being on sabbatical.
There's been a lot of scholarly discourse. There's been a lot of yoga and downward facing dog. So it's been a time of rest and reflection for me.
But you're actually here at a conference, aren't you?
Indeed, I am. Yeah.
So I've been able to come in on a little bit of your downtime at a conference. And you have called me up here to show me this. Now, it's a pity that we're on radio, because what you're showing me is, I think this is a Bruegel painting.
Indeed it is. And I carry it with me wherever I go. My small picture of Bruegel's landscape with the fall of Icarus goes with me wherever I go, and it sits beside me in my bedroom in the hotel here.
Should I describe?
I'd love you to do that.
For the listeners, what I'm looking at, it's not an overly large painting. It's about 40-odd inches.
By 29?
29 inches high. What I'm looking at is a rather happy scene from a hill overlooking a bay. In the bay, there is a sailing ship with one of its sails flying out ahead of it. Up on top of the hill, there is a man in a green coat who is ploughing a field. He's holding the wooden plough behind a cow or a bull or bullock, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Down a level below him, on a cliff a little lower down, there is a sheep herder with a number of sheep that look rather dangerously perched on the cliff. And there looks like a couple of people standing waist-deep in the water fishing or something on there. Is that...
Absolutely. It's sort of a mixture, isn't it, Will, between a pastoral landscape showing heroic people going, common people going about their daily work, and a seascape, because there's a ship in full sail. I don't know, what sort of a ship is that, Will? You're the nautical man.
I think it's a caravel.
Okay.
It's probably a Portuguese caravel.
And you're probably wondering then why this Peter Bruegel picture from the 1560s stirs me so. And the reason is that in that description you've just given, you've omitted, because it's so insignificant, at the bottom right-hand side of the picture plane, you see two little legs plummeting into the ocean.
Ah, this is the fall of Icarus.
Indeed it is. And Bruegel's intent with this work is to say that we all live our own happy lives or get on with our working lives, and that in every day as we perform the ordinary, there are little tragedies going on around us that we don't know about.
Well, it might also mean that in our failure we get to return to what for everyone else is a very happy time. And so Icarus's plunge from his flight too close to the sun, he's returned to the sea. He may have plunged in, but life goes on.
Absolutely the theme of the painting. And I think people forget that what happened before that moment where he plunges to the sea was that he actually completed a sort of a triumph. And that after a triumph, there's inevitably a fall. And Lance Armstrong could tell you a few things about that. But this painting not only struck me, but it also struck the very famous poet W.H. Auden, who in his poem Musée des Beaux-Arts talks about this particular painting. Can I read it to you?
Please do. It's a fabulous garden, I might say. I'm listening to the birds here, and there's a wasp's nest up there.
Oh,
I see. I can hear
fabulous.
The wasps.
I'm allergic. You might have to have an anaphylactic moment.
It's a lovely garden. So please give us the W.H. Auden poem.
Yes, and look, I won't read all of it, but there's a couple of sections that I think really resonate with this picture. It starts off by saying, "About suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position. How it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along." And later in the poem he says, in Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The ploughman may have heard the splash, but for him it was not an important failure. The sun shone as it had on to the white legs disappearing into the green water, and the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to and sailed calmly on. And in fact, it reminds me of another painting, Will, that was done a lot later, in 1893, by Edvard Munch, of The Scream, a very well-known painting, where in Munch's painting you see in the background on a bridge two people walking along, but in the foreground somebody has turned away and put their hands to their head and emitted a guttural scream. And it was a moment where the world's carrying on as normal, but behind all those normal workday things can often lie little human tragedies.
Wow, and that the profound thread that we speak about each time we're on the air with RPP is connecting those two. And do you think that connection continues on?
Oh, even I do further? Indeed.
I can think of one example myself, and probably something we can revisit, but Norval Watson's surf art. I'm looking at this Bruegel painting with the curvature in the horizon is something that's very common in Norval Watson's work in his surf art. It's almost like a bird's eye view of the earth.
And Agreed, and almost a naive art. It's there's something about it that's very honest and very innocent, and I totally agree that there is an influence there in the work of our very own.
And thus we see the profound thread once again. So that's been very interesting, and I'm glad that I made the effort to come up and catch you. And I hear that someone's calling you now. You've got to go back in, so I'm going to pack up and get out of your road. But thank you for giving us the time again. And perhaps next time we can get together in my world and we could have a look at some of that surf art and have a talk about that and how that's connected to
Sounds fantastic.
Renaissance art. Thank you, Gabe.
And now it's time for John On. There's the sting, and guess what? There he is too.
I know, it seems so much more appropriate when he's in the room, doesn't it?
And now it's time for John. That doesn't sound the same at all.
No, you're out of practice, Swanee.
It's possibly having to come in here wearing that equestrian dressage costume, Swan, that's getting in your way. Now, listen, let's get on with John On.
Yes.
Just, I can see Swan leaning towards the mic there.
Swanee doesn't know what we've been saying about him in his absence, does he?
Jets. I found myself staying in a hotel in the middle of the Melbourne Grand Prix recently, if you can imagine such a thing.
Not much sleeping, I wouldn't have thought.
No, they don't do it at night.
Don't they?
You can sleep at night, but it's very noisy during the day. And we were hanging around a bit there in the hotel. I went out to the front of the hotel, and the guy was flying the F-18 fighter plane around the place.
Oh.
And
the guy?
Yeah, well, more about the guy in a little while. But this jet was flying around, and incredible thing. It is just an amazing thing, a great big jet. And he was doing, not really tricks, they're kind of like, I think they're more combat manoeuvres actually, that kind of thing. Flying it, it's on its side, flying it almost upside down. He stood it on its tail at one stage down at the end of the park and pretty well just sat there until he burst off into the upper atmosphere. Well, almost, just
really?
Like running the jet into the ground below him and almost sitting there on its tail.
Wow.
And so he was doing that for a while, and then later on in the evening we were going out, and in the forecourt of the hotel was a little group of Air Force guys, and I pointed to them and I said, "You the pilot?" I pointed at this guy and I said, "Were you the pilot today?" And he said, "No, he was," and pointed to the guy sitting next to him, standing next to him. And I went and introduced myself to him, shook his hand, young Ben. And as you can imagine, Ben is maybe 25 years old, very bright, very fit. And, well, so, Swan's doing a bit of a salute in the background there. And it wasn't really like that. It was just... like, obviously, a young man at the top of his game. Mm. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been doing what he was doing on that day. And now I'm going to get from there to abstract painting, as I mentioned earlier.
Yes.
And it led me to think about Tony Tuckson, who's a great abstract Australian painter, but he started his life as a fighter pilot.
Well, could I just interject for a second there? Because psychological profiles demonstrate that to be a pilot, you have to have a very creative, artistic mind.
Right.
So there is a psychological similarity.
Well, Tony Tuckson definitely had that in spades. He flew Spitfires in England during the war, and he came out here, was an administrator and instructor in Wirraways in Darwin. And so he's very good at what he did. But he did a kind of a reverse flip into art because he was an administrator and he went and ran the New South Wales Art Gallery.
Oh.
And he was crucial in that gallery, changing from the old Victorian building that was in the park into the new building. It's very much the Tuckson building, the new gallery there. And also in building the Aboriginal art collection that they have there. He was up around Melville Island and up around northern, north of the Northern Territory in the early 1960s collecting stuff. And then after he'd done all of that, he decided to take up painting. And he exhibited 6 paintings in 15 years.
Not a lot.
Not a lot. And then turned some kind of corner. And in the last 10 years before he died, he was having exhibitions in commercial galleries in Sydney with 60 paintings in them.
Wow.
And which is when he began the abstract painting process that he got involved in. And the paintings are terrific. They're very simple, but they have some kind of magnetic appeal, at least to me. I've always wanted to own one, but could never afford one, I'm afraid.
Mm.
Or an F-18.
Can I just say one thing about young Ben?
Yes.
Pardon me. There are old pilots and there are bold pilots, but there are no old, bold pilots.
Ah.
Funny. Boom, boom. Is that where you go, boom, boom? Funnily enough, actually, I was reading an article just the other day about Clive James, because he's reached the end of his life. And several years ago...
He's dying, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He's got various forms of cancer and leukemia and so on. But he has become incredibly prolific in the last few years of his life. He says that a lot of that is to do with his impending death, which seems to be more protracted than he expected. But
I'm running out of time. I better get on with it.
Yeah, but there's been a font of creativity that's come from that. So perhaps that's what happened to Tony.
Perhaps, but I think it was also a matter of him getting a grip on what he wanted to do with abstract painting at a time when he surrendered his administrative tasks at the gallery. He had time on his hands, as well as running out of time. He had time on his hands, and he produced a lot of work.
How interesting, John, as usual.
We're very lucky once again to have friend of the show and Renaissance Authority, Professor Holbrook, with us. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Peter.
And welcome back to the Peninsula.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, Peter, last time we spoke, it was on the Shakespeare authorship question, and you came down most emphatically on the pro-Shakespeare side. But one of the authors that's often touted as a candidate is the dark horse of the Renaissance, Christopher Marlowe. Isn't that right?
Yes, I think it's a relatively recent phenomenon, this idea of that Shakespeare may have been Marlowe. It's quite as loony as all of the other suggestions, but it's unfortunate in a way, because Marlowe is such an interesting figure in his own right that trying fancifully to connect him to the works of Shakespeare, as some people do, is a bit of a distraction. The really interesting question, I think, is the relationship between Marlowe and Shakespeare, which is a very important one, and also Marlowe's own work. So that's a wonderful area of investigation, and not just area of investigation. I mean, these are plays which are still performed, and so they should be. They're fantastic.
Because we're all in the shadow of Shakespeare. Perhaps you could just tell us some of Marlowe's most significant works, something that we might all know.
Yes, the main play that people will know is Dr. Faustus. And this is a play about a scholar, Faustus, in Germany. The story is not Marlowe's invention. It's told in many different versions in Europe. And it's a story really about a man who seeks absolute knowledge. And in order to gain this knowledge, he trades salvation for absolute. The term is necromancy, which really just means magical power. The great thing about the play is that he gets this, all of this knowledge, and he makes this terrible pact with the devil. And I think the really attractive thing about Faustus is that he doesn't use it for pure power. He's a figure of play. So he has a lot of fun during the play. It's relatively harmless fun. He pokes fun at the Pope, and he performs various tricks, and he summons back Helen, the most beautiful woman of ancient Greece, and he can enjoy the sight of her. And all of this is rather harmless and rather attractive, I think, in the character. I mean, you can imagine other people who, if they had this absolute knowledge, would use it to dominate and exploit others. He doesn't do that.
Well, I can imagine people like you who have risen to a position of power at the University of Queensland probably wield it in a more merciless way. Now, Marlowe, of course, he's got a bit of a bad boy reputation, and in that age of pantaloons and jolly old bosomy fun, he must have been a standout bad boy to get this reputation.
He was, absolutely. He comes to a bad end. He's He's born in 1564. That's the same year that Shakespeare's born. But he dies much earlier than Shakespeare. Shakespeare dies in 1616. Marlowe is killed in a brawl in a tavern in 1593 in a place called Deptford, which is near London, a suburb. And this is, as you say, he is someone... It's the kind of end, in a way, that you might have predicted for Marlowe, because he was someone that seems to have actively sought out trouble.
And a troublemaker he was. He was spied on. He caused a lot of trouble in his time, didn't he?
Yes. There's a fascinating document from the age called the Baines Note. It's a document, a short document, which lists the damnable opinions and heresies of Christopher Marley, or Marlowe. The name is spelt in all sorts of different ways. And in this document, now, Baines is an intelligencer, that's to say a spy of the Elizabethan government. And there is some suggestion that Marlowe himself may at one time or another have worked for the government's intelligence services, possibly spying on Catholic recusants. These are people who do not conform to the established Anglican Church. And it's all a little unclear, but there does seem to be the suggestion that Marlowe knew this rather shady world of spies and intelligences. And Baines is one of these people, and he produces a document which lists some of these...
Indiscretions.
The document itself is actually very, very shocking, I think. It's full of blasphemy. It's full of... these are blasphemies attributed to Marlowe. And it's an extraordinary document because it gives us the kind of... The netherworld or the underside of the Elizabethan age. You know, we think of this period as one in which religion was dominant. Here we have a figure described in hair-raising terms as being a figure of blasphemy and atheism.
So, Peter, you might say that he was the Baines of Marlowe's life.
Very nice. Now, in fact, Marlowe is the kind of figure who... I think, as I just said, he is inevitably going to come to that sort of end. Yes, he was the Baines of Marlowe's life.
So just paint us a picture. What would a bad boy of the Elizabethan era be up to on any one day? Presumably he'd be hard at work at the quill early in the morning. There'd be some linen-y wench in his bed. And what happens next?
Well, difficult to speculate, but let me just say that one of the aspects of Marlowe's life that seems to be reasonably well attested to, this is partly through the Baines note, this list of his opinions, is that he may have been, and probably I think almost certainly was, gay. And this comes out in some of the plays. There is a homoerotic or homosexual there, because they didn't use those words at the time.
And not that there's anything wrong with that.
But the plays are full of male-to-male desire. And one of the most interesting of these is a historical play called Edward II. So a feature of Marlowe's career is that it anticipates Shakespeare. These are two playwrights who are dealing with very similar topics. So when Marlowe writes a play about an unsuccessful English king who is eventually murdered, Shakespeare later writes a play about an unsuccessful English king who comes to a bad end. And this is, you get the sense of these two working the same territory, competing with each other. They're rivals, they're friends, they're from different acting companies. Shakespeare, of course, goes on to become a very wealthy man. I don't think the same can be said of Marlowe. He, as I said, comes to an early and a bad end.
Well, I can assume he was too busy pissing his royalties up against a wall somewhere.
Well, he's certainly a character who seems to live a sort of reckless life. And just to go back to Edward II, the really fascinating thing about that play is that Edward is figured as someone who is in love with a favourite called Gaveston. Gaveston has returned from the French court, and he's a base-born character. That's to say, he's not a noble. And the nobles in the play are outraged at the favouritism that Edward displays towards Gaveston. And there is a very strong suggestion of a love relationship between these two. Now, I think what's wonderful about the play is that it doesn't treat this in censorious terms. Far from it. I feel that the nobles in the play are heavy and bullying and brutal. And Edward and Gaveston create for themselves, I think, a lovely world of poetry and music and love. And this is, in my opinion, in the terms of the play, infinitely preferable to these bullying aristocratic types.
Well, I've always much preferred the company of a bunch of gay dancers than the brutal kind of ochre males. I can understand that. I think you describe Paddington in the here and now there.
He's great for Gamalo. I think he stands for a kind of sexual freedom and a kind of... it's a different sort of heroism that we're getting in that play. It's not military heroism, it's not political heroism, it's the heroism of private life and of love life and also of art. Edward is a connoisseur. He's a connoisseur of beauty. And one of the things that Gaveston's sort of role in the court is to provide entertainments. And this is the other thing, of course, about Marlowe. He represents, I should have said that like Shakespeare, he comes from a middle-class background. Shakespeare is the son of a leather worker, a glove maker. Marlowe is the son of a shoemaker. Unlike Shakespeare, he's lucky enough to go to university. He goes to Cambridge, where he gets a very good classical education. Now, in all of Marlowe's plays, I think you frequently have the figure of the outsider, be it Dr. Faustus, who is base-born, or Gaveston in Edward II. And Edward II is an outsider insofar he's a king, of course, but he's also, there is a strong suggestion of him being an outsider to the reigning values of the aristocracy, you know, which is about war and power and conquest. And Edward is just not interested in that. Now, I think this is really fascinating because you've got someone who is himself, that's to say Marlowe, an outsider to the Elizabethan power structure, who through the creativity of his own art and his wit and his education rises to a position of cultural power on the stage. So this is a fascinating trajectory. You've got someone who's really, through the sheer force of art and imagination, coming to occupy a very powerful role, putting on these plays for thousands of people in the English theatres of the time, and sympathetic, I think, as a result, to outsiders. The plays are so often about outsiders.
And in a sense, very physically expressed his disdain for that whole world by just being a mad, brawling, drunken bastard, perhaps.
Well, that might be perhaps
reading a little too much into
it. But look, he is someone who, as I say, is given to... He seems to have been one of these people who want to shock. So in the Baines note, for example, we're told that he has many times read an atheist lecture. Now, we don't know what this lecture would have consisted of, but there are other damnable opinions listed in the Baines note, which give us maybe something of its flavour. For example, we're told that Marlowe said that Moses was but a juggler, meaning a juggler is the old word for magician. What he probably meant there was someone who could use clever tricks in order to persuade the Jews that he was a divinely inspired prophet, which is what, of course, the Bible tells us. We're told that Sir Thomas Harriot's man could do anything that Moses could do. Now, what Marlowe was referring to here is a mathematician, a really famous mathematician and scientist of the day, Sir Thomas Harriot. Sir Thomas Harriot is in the retinue of Sir Walter Raleigh, the explorer and discoverer and philosopher and poet. And Harriot is very interested in new technology, like optics and lens making was very much an avant-garde technology of the period. And the suggestion is that Moses was someone who may have been in touch with secret arts and technologies, who could therefore delude the people into believing that he was a divinely inspired prophet. So this is extraordinary stuff to have said at this period.
A profound blasphemy.
He was a bad boy, as you've said. He also stands for a more humane ethos, I think. It's an ethos of love, of pleasure, of art and of beauty. And I think for that we should honour his memory.
And I think
and we should honour his art above all. And that's the main thing. The poetry is extraordinary.
I think we should congratulate ourselves for managing this on a Sunday morning after such a wild night. Thank you very much, Professor Peter Holbrook. Last time we didn't have it ready, but here's your friend of the show badge. We want you to wear it on your lapel at your next faculty meeting. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a summer version of Arts About, a compilation of interviews we pre-recorded last year and some past highlights to keep you amused while we have a break. If you've only just tuned in, you can catch up on the show via podcast, which should appear on the station website sometime tomorrow, or hear us repeated on air and streaming Wednesdays at 12 after Secrets to Health with Angela Jacobson. We'll be back behind the mics in person at the end of the month, but in the meantime, remember, we may not know everything about art, but we know what we like.